From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, learning the ropes of serving in Congress.
People aren't asking you to solve every one of their problems. They're asking you to care about their lives and what happens to them and their kids, and to fight for them.
Teachers getting politically active.
Politics today is sounding like a grammar lesson, so that it's like, here's the rule, but here is an exception. Here's another rule, but here are three exceptions.
The United Methodists vote to tighten their ban on gay clergy and same-sex marriage. We hear from pastors who are for and against.
There are so many other necessary needs of people's lives that are not focused on who they are sleeping with. And I would like to see our denomination focus on other needs.
I and many of my colleagues throughout the United States, the state of Michigan, the city of Ann Arbor, and throughout the globe are really heartbroken today.
Hello, welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The nation's second largest Protestant denomination voted Tuesday to keep in place its official opposition to same-sex marriage and gay clergy. Later this hour, we talk with two Methodist ministers who are having different feelings about this vote. But first, the freshman members of the 116th Congress have begun their congressional careers right in the middle of one of the most critical, tumultuous times in American history, all playing out around them as they learn the ropes. Stateside will be checking in periodically with one of these new lawmakers, with 8th District Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin, to find out what it's like being transformed into a member of Congress. She's with us now. Representative Slotkin, welcome.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, there's no denying this is a very crucial day on Capitol Hill with Michael Cohen's public testimony. And I know you're not on the House Oversight Committee, but we're all hearing and reading what President Trump's former lawyer is saying with explosive allegations about the president. What do we do with this?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. I mean, I think I haven't been able to watch much of the testimony. I've been in my own hearings. I think that I'm not sure it's actually going to change anyone's mind. I think if you're inclined to be sort of frustrated with the president, you're still frustrated with the president. And if you're inclined to believe that there's a witch hunt, then you believe it's just a continuation of a witch hunt. So I'm not sure what it's going to do with it, but it does pressurize the situation, unfortunately, for whenever Director Mueller puts out his report. So I think it just kind of adds to the stress of the moment for when that report is actually released.
And speaking of the stress of the moment, really the eye of this hurricane, and there you are on Capitol Hill, how has that been for you? What has that been like?
Yeah, you know, I think that one of the things that's sort of immediately apparent when you are a new member of Congress, especially if you're sent to Congress from a district like mine, where people just want me to get something done. They want me to work bipartisan. They want to affect the price of health care, prescription drugs, get an infrastructure bill. I think coming into a hyper-pressurized political environment is always tough, right? Because it makes it that much harder to work across the aisle and to actually make progress. So it's frustrating, I would say, because people are expecting me to actually improve their lives and help their pocketbooks or their kids. But, you know, I've done what I can. I almost immediately started a bipartisan freshman group, 7 Democrats, 7 Republicans, all new to Congress, so we're not too cynical yet, just to get to know each other, just to kind of know each other as human beings, so that when we have to work on these really highly political topics, we have a relationship, and that's been really important.
Late yesterday, as we all know, the House voted to repeal President Trump's emergency declaration, his bid to divert money to the wall. So the showdown between the House, between Congress and the White House, it is on. How do you see this playing out?
I mean, you know, I just believe we have to be a nation of rules and laws, and we have to follow the Constitution as established by our founders, that there are two co-equal branches of government. I honestly think that this will probably be worked out in the courts. I'm not sure that the vote is going to fundamentally change the calculus of things. I was happy to see a number of Republicans sign on, including 2 from Michigan, to sign on along with a big group of Democrats. But I honestly think that this is going to play out in the courts and therefore is going to take a long time.
Let's turn to foreign affairs. You spent your career in the CIA. You're on the Homeland Security Committee and the Armed Services Committee. And I know you were in Munich, and VP Pence was speaking there. You heard during his speech that stone silence from our allies at what were clearly meant to be applause lines. What are you hearing in your conversation with our allies?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, we've gotten to the point now where they just, a lot of our allies feel alienated and you know, taken for granted by the president. And in particular, you know, you have allies who are fighting with us in places like Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan, and they're finding out about our moves, you know, leaving Syria, for instance. Many of our allies who are risking their soldiers' lives found out via tweet that we were leaving Syria. As you can imagine, that does not set us up for success the next time we go to those same allies and ask them to fight with us. So I think the allies are expressing a real sense of frustration, and therefore they weren't even willing to kind of politely clap during the vice president's speech. It was definitely noticeable. And, you know, I think it's why I was really, really intent on going on the bipartisan delegation. I went with, led by Senator Graham, because I wanted to demonstrate to our allies that just because the president treats you, you know, in a cavalier way doesn't mean that Congress and lots of other senior leaders in Washington don't care about you and aren't seeing what you're seeing. And so I wanted to send that signal, put my money where my mouth was, and show up. And we had the largest congressional delegation, bipartisan congressional delegation ever in the history of the Munich Security Conference, and it's 40 years.
Is there a sense that your presence and conversations that you had with folks from other countries, from our allies, can that repair the frayed and damaged relationships that our country is having?
Well, I think it helps, right? They hear multiple voices. And I think that most of these countries, certainly their senior leaders, they're used to having a strong American leadership role in the world. They want that. Again, we're not perfect, and it's right to question some of the moves we've made in the past couple of decades. But I think a lot of them see us as an indispensable leader on things like arms control, or when it comes to the role in NATO, when it comes to fighting back terrorists. And I think that there is always the potential for new senior leaders to come in and to sort of express a different view. And so I don't think it's irreparably damaged, but I think in the meantime, we have to do everything we can from Congress to send a strong signal that the American handshake means something and that we care about our allies participating with us to counter global threats.
Representative Slatkin, what are you hearing from the people of the 8th District, your constituents, about the foreign affairs, about our relationship with our allies? Is this on people's radar screens, or are they more focusing on challenges right here at home?
So they're focused on challenges at home, but it's interesting. I just was meeting this past weekend with a bunch of senior officials from Livingston County, both at the township level, mayors, city managers, and one of the conversations that kept coming up was the concern about cyber threats. Right? Little townships who have been the victim of phishing attempts, you know, this where they lost their data at the township level because of an attack. We've had communities in our district who have been the victim of ransomware attacks where they've actually paid the ransom in order to get the data back, a lot of it being personal data. So it's amazing how even in small places, you know, where they have less than 1,200 citizens, their little township leadership is worried about what are very global threats, like cyber threats. So I do think that there's a real nexus with what people are worried about. And I think that people understand that the American handshake has to mean something. They want to believe and know that our leaders are being respected wherever we go. And I don't think anyone likes when the vice president of the United States goes to an international conference and doesn't get the applause, right? That doesn't feel good to anybody.
The GOP has put a target on your back. You're on the list of 55 Democrats they've targeted for 2020 because, as we all know, you flipped your district last November. How do you advance your agenda, your ideas, knowing the GOP is going to pounce and pounce hard next year? What does that calculus look like?
Yeah, well, they fought hard last time. And listen, you just can't run your life based in fear. I'm not going to do that. You have to focus on what people need and helping people's pocketbooks and their kids. It's what I said during my campaign last time, and it's what I still really believe. And if you do those things, then I don't think it matters how many negative ads they throw at you. People know that you're trying to fight for them. And, you know, people say to me, like, you sound like a normal person, you talk like a normal person, and you show up at our stuff. People aren't asking you to solve every one of their problems. They're asking you to care about their lives and what happens to them and their kids, and to fight for them. And that's something I know how to do. So it, you know, I know the other side is going to fight, but all I can do is do the right thing for my district and hope that people see that and respect that.
And to that point, you've made a real push toward on-the-ground services to your constituents. What are you doing that's different?
Yeah, so I think most people have no idea what their member of Congress actually does for them and can do for them. I certainly didn't know. Before I ran for Congress, I had never reached out to my member of Congress. I had never sort of known what they can do for me. Most people know what a mayor can do or what the president can do, but the member of Congress is kind of a funny in-between position. So the number one thing we have to do is tell people how we can help. So we have offices in Lansing. We'll have another office in Rochester. We have a Livingston County representative, and the things that we can help with are, first and foremost, constituent services on things like Social Security benefits, VA benefits, immigration issues. We handle a ton of immigration issues, where sometimes just someone who knows the system really well can help free up, you know, some stuck benefits. And sometimes a letter from a member of Congress can help unstick things that haven't been fixed in the past. So there's a lot of constituent services. And then there's just talking to issue groups, making sure we know what's going on and what's of greatest concern in the district so that I can react to that and vote accordingly back in Washington. The other thing that we're doing is setting up district advisory boards. So, for instance, on prescription drugs, you know, if I'm going to be voting on a piece of legislation that's meant to lower the cost of prescription drugs, I should have people who deal with that issue every day from the district advising me and telling me what they think about the legislation. So we're setting up these district advisory boards to be kind of my issue experts to make sure I'm not missing something and how a law might affect people on the ground specifically. And then just showing up at lots of events, at lots of community meetings, making sure we're present so that people can communicate their concerns directly to us and they don't have to wait.
Well, I know you have to go take a vote, so we're going to let you go.
Thank you.
Democratic Representative Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan's 8th Congressional District. Thank you so much.
Thanks, as always.
Coming up, before he was Detroit's mayor, Coleman A. Young was an activist, a labor organizer, which in 1952 caught the eye of the House Un-American Activities Committee.
I'm here to aid in any fight against un-American activities. I consider un-American activities those of the Klan, the denial of the right to vote of Negroes all over the South.
That is after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is Wednesday, time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center.
The United Nations considers a war stopped even more important than a war won.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
Most people remember Coleman Alexander Young as the five-term mayor of Detroit. But 67 years ago this week, the hunt for communists came to Detroit and Coleman Young was in the spotlight. Rachel Clark of the Michigan History Center is here with us. And Rachel, this all happened when the House Un-American Activities Committee traveled from Washington to Detroit searching for communists in workplaces and in local government. So before we talk about Coleman Young before that committee, what was going on in the country that fired up this quest to find communists?
Well, it's the very beginning of the Cold War, and in August of 1949, the Soviets successfully test their first nuclear weapon. So fear is really fueling the search for communists throughout the country. People are afraid of Joseph Stalin and his communist regime.
In fact, I'm thinking of movies at the time. There was such a fear of atomic war mm-hmm. and communists. There was a very popular radio drama with Dana Andrews, I Was a Communist for the mm-hmm. FBI. So yeah, so this was all inflamed. So here we are. February 28, 1952, a full 2 years, right, before the infamous McCarthy hearings.
Yes.
Why were they in Detroit?
So they come to Detroit mostly looking for communist activity throughout the labor movement. And Detroit at that time is the center of labor, especially post-war production. So they head to Detroit and are looking into groups like the UAW, the CIO, searching for communists.
And why was Coleman Alexander Young called to testify before this committee?
After the war, he is heavily involved in the labor movement with again, the UAW, the CIO, the National Negro Labor Council. And he's very outspoken about this discrimination in the labor industry. He's considered very radical. His work associates are caught in the attention of the House committee. And so he is called in to testify, not only on his own activities, but the activities of his friends.
Who's questioning him? We're going to listen to how things started off, but who is it asking questions?
For the most part, it's a person named Frank Tavner. He is an attorney from Virginia, and he is chief counsel for the House committee from 1949 to the mid-1950s.
Okay, let's take a listen to how things started off.
But I desire to ask you the question which I have asked other witnesses. Are you now a member of the Communist Party?
I refuse to answer that question because relying upon my rights under the Fifth Amendment and in recognition of the fact that an answer to such a question before such a committee would be, in my opinion, a violation of my rights under the First Amendment. And further, since I have no purpose of being here as a stool pigeon, I am not prepared to give information on my associates or my political thoughts.
So that feisty, outspoken Coleman Young that many of us came to know after he became Detroit's mayor in 1974 was certainly on full display in 1952. How did the questioning proceed from that start, Rachel?
So after he is asked about his communist associations or activities, it goes on to basically Coleman Young in the most articulate way I think I've ever heard not answering anything. He pleads the Fifth, which any person who is called before the House Un-American Activities Committee is allowed to do. So he refuses to answer questions under the Fifth Amendment. And interestingly enough, in that last clip, you hear him also refuse under his First Amendment right and right of association. So Tavner, at this point, he had been through a lot of hearings. He was actually part of the Hollywood hearings where scores of people in the entertainment industry lose their careers because of either their testimony or the refusal to testify. So Tavner had been at this for a while by this point, but Coleman Young is ready to go. And the questions continue about his activities and his associations, and he just absolutely refuses to answer anything.
And then it seems like he takes this quest for communism, you know, looking for communists, and he really kind of yanks it over to what is his interest. Let's listen to another clip, and then we'll talk about that.
We're here to find out the extent of communist activities in this area.
I'm here
you're
to testify.
You're in a position where you can help and aid, if you will. But the attitude you're taking certainly is not conducive to such an investigation.
I'm here to aid in any fight against un-American activities.
I consider
un-American activities those of the Klan, the denial of the right to vote of Negroes all over the South.
Do you consider the activities of the Communist Party as un-American?
I consider the activities of this committee, as it cites people for reputedly being communists,
just a moment,
as an un-American activity.
So Coleman Young's like, let's talk about racial injustice. Forget this search for communists under every rock, right? He's like, let's talk about the fact you're not letting black people in the South vote.
He does. After the war, he's very active in pointing out discrimination in industry, in society. That's sort of one of the things that he really focuses on. And as anyone has ever been dressed down by Coleman Young knows, that when he wants to talk about something, he absolutely will. And when he doesn't want to talk about something, he absolutely won't. And he goes into the conversation about the rights of African Americans in America at that point. And later in the testimony, he actually makes comments about people on the committee being elected to their office because Black Southerners are not allowed to vote or cannot vote easily. So he brings out the injustices that he sees in America and throws it back at the committee over and over again through his testimony while he's also pleading the Fifth on the question that he's being asked.
So this was, a very skillful performance and a very firmly rooted points of view in front of this committee.
He does. He truly believed in what he was saying and his rights. By that time, Coleman Young, you know, this is prior to the Coleman Young that a lot of people in Michigan remember, but he had been around. He'd been in the military. He had a pretty decent education growing up. He'd had a lot of life experiences, even by this point. He was still pretty young. And he really looks at this as not only an affront to all Americans, but sort of almost an insult to him at having to testify to be un-American to a group of people who sort of support other un-American activities in this country.
And ultimately, did those HUAC hearings in Detroit really result in finding any communists?
No. In the 40s and 50s, the Communist Party did exist in this country. It had been very popular in the 20s and 30s, pre-World War II. It wasn't seen as something un-American, necessarily. And by the 40s and 50s, because of what's going on in the Soviet Union, there is this fear-mongering going on. And there are people that still believe in that communist sort of ideal. But nothing is really found that's substantial at all, not only in this hearing, but in most of the hearings. It's very much a lot of people lose their livelihoods because they are either falsely accused or just refuse to testify.
As you've intimated, Rachel, refusing to answer questions from the House Un-American Activities Committee wound up ending the careers of many people. We can certainly point to people in Hollywood whose careers were completely derailed, but not Coleman Young. Why is that?
He didn't have a whole lot to lose at that point. He didn't have a career that was taking off. He was still working sort of not necessarily odd jobs, but he was working to make ends meet. He was working on projects that he believed in, but he didn't really have a quote unquote career trajectory that could be derailed by these hearings. So he had not a whole lot to lose by speaking his mind and refusing to testify.
And ultimately, what became of the House Un-American Activities Committee?
So in 1950, Joseph McCarthy gets involved in the hearings. And although he is not part of the committee, he makes these rampant, unfounded accusations that the committee found very difficult to control. So the committee's credibility is pretty much destroyed throughout the McCarthy hearings. And those are the ones that people really think about when they think of these House Un-American Activities Committee meetings or hearings. So by 1959, they've really lost their credibility. Harry Truman calls them the most un-American thing in the country. And then in the 60s, you get protests and riots at the hearings. And that, along with the changing political and cultural landscape, lead to the committee finally just being terminated by 1975.
Some fascinating history. Rachel Clark, Michigan History Center, taking us back 67 years to the testimony of Detroit's future mayor, Coleman A. Young, before a hearing of the House Un-American Activities Committee. Rachel, fascinating stuff. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
Time for our regular reminder. We always look forward to hearing from you. What stories are you focusing on? What issues or people do you want to hear more about? Just let us know. Find us on Facebook, search for Michigan Radio. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And as always, MichiganRadio.org, and just click the link that says Stateside. In the United States of 2019, virtually everywhere you turn, you will encounter politics. And that's certainly true for our teachers. More of them are becoming politically active. Why is this, and what role should teachers play in the broader political landscape? We turn to Michigan Radio's education commentator, Hall of Fame teacher Matinga Ragatz, with us via Skype again. So, Matinga, why are more teachers running for office and getting involved in politics? What's driving them?
Oh my gosh, it is simple. We need government that we can explain to the kids. So the political system that we teach to the kids is democratic, it's fair, it's just, and it ought to work for the majority of people. But politics today is sounding like a grammar lesson, so that it's like, here's the rule, but here is an exception. Here's another rule, but here are three exceptions, right? So now our students have access to so much more information, and they're finding that there's a giant disconnect between what they're taught in class and what they see online. So many teachers, they are, you know, surrounded by a population of kids who quickly learn that the government does not work for them, whether it's for, whether them feeling safe from gun violence, or whether there's laws about ripping the families apart, or if it's keep them in perpetual poverty. How do we explain to the kids the government system if the government system seems to them like it doesn't work?
One of the people who stepped up to run for office here in Michigan was Grand Ledge High School civics teacher Justin Heaney. He ran for U.S. representative in 2012. And here's what he said about what teachers bring to the political realm.
Discipline, mm-hmm. reasonableness, mm-hmm. patience, intelligence, a connection with people, children, though they're not voting citizens, they are a representation of the community. I think a level of integrity that was missing and is missing in politics.
What would you add to that, Matinga? What do teachers bring to the table?
I need to just continue that stream of thought, because there's a quality of behavior that we must teach and model for students that is completely in direct opposition to political culture. So while other professions, for example, may take the law and bend it to their benefit, teachers must role model and practice what they preach in the classroom.
I'm wondering about rules. Are there rules in place around political speech at the district level? Do school boards have any say-so?
Yeah, so most school boards and most administrators want to maintain a moderate and a neutral tone, because there is a lot of community blowback sometimes. And the schools will take positions. We have seen them take positions about gender-neutral bathrooms, or whether or not students are allowed to take a knee at sports events, or whether teachers can live stream controversial congressional testimony.
We certainly saw the differences in districts with student walkouts on gun control after the Parkland shooting. It was
That's
very
right.
Different.
We saw that. And again, some schools allowed it and some schools did not.
You would actually talk to a teacher who has waded into a very hot button issue in today's political climate, Rick Joseph. He teaches fifth and sixth grade at Birmingham Covington School. He was part of a recent group of teachers who traveled to Texas to the U.S.-Mexico border to advocate against the detention of migrant youth. And here's what he has to say.
We're also important players in the political process as far as what ultimately gets funded, mm-hmm. because the funding is, of course, determined by political actors, by legislators. And the legislators, in many cases, in most cases, are not educators themselves. And even if they were educators once upon a time, it's important to have the voice of a practicing educator to have a current pulse on the situation as it exists now.
Is there a place for a teacher to take stands on politically charged issues like immigration or abortion or climate change?
You know, it's tricky, because the teachers have two roles that they have to play, or at least I see two important roles that they have to play. The first one is, you know, we need to role model civic engagement. If we're going to talk to the kids about, you know, going out and participating in the political process, it's very, very important for them to see us participate. And in Rick's case, it was important for him, for the kids to, you know, read that article that talked about him going to the border and advocating for kids as well.
You know, there are people listening to us, I bet a lot of parents, who might say teachers should not be involved in politics at all because it could impact their ability to be fair and to teach objectively, to be neutral. What would you say to them?
Well, and if that's true, I may say to those parents that maybe parents should not be involved in political discussions because it might impact their ability to be fair and objective parenting. I mean, that sentence makes just as much sense. You know, teachers are not responsible for the political mess, so you cannot send the messenger to detention. See what I did there?
Yes, you did. You did that very, very well. So when you think of a teacher inside the classroom and a political discussion comes up, we know that, you know, the teacher is a facilitator or a moderator for the student's own discussion. Does that neutral position as a moderator become compromised with activism outside the classroom?
No, it does not. And especially if you do it in a professional way. So, if it's obvious that you hold a position, it is very important that when you discuss the opposing view, you have to have other people. You know, for example, with today's technology, you can invite professionals that are expert, that are very eloquent and very knowledgeable about a position that you may that be completely opposite to you, so that the kids can weigh in a very informed manner and come up with their own positions. That's my role as a teacher. It's not my role to proselytize or try to change their ideology.
Matinga Ragatz is in the National Teachers Hall of Fame, and she is Michigan Radio's education commentator. As always, Matinga, thanks so much.
Thank you so very much.
It was a curious shout-out right in the middle of an Oscar acceptance speech on Sunday night. Director Peter Farrelly getting his Oscar for Best Original Screenplay for Green Book, dropping a torrent of names in his thank yous, and then comes this.
Tom Cartsonis and Shinola Watches, unbelievable. They're saving Detroit.
Well, that line got quite a response from Detroiters who begged to differ, jumped on social media to say so. Tomorrow on Stateside, we'll have a conversation about who gets to decide who is saving Detroit or whether Detroit needs saving at all.
The people who are on the ground here, who have invested, who have stayed for generations, who stayed when it wasn't cute or fun, even in some cases safe, they ultimately really have to be the decision makers, and they have to be the ones who are kind of charting Detroit's future.
That is tomorrow on Stateside. Coming up, the nation's second largest Protestant denomination voted yesterday to uphold its opposition to same-sex marriage and gay clergy. The debate leading up to the vote was highly contentious.
And as an African-American pastor in Flint, Michigan, there are so many other necessary needs of people's lives that are not focused on who they are sleeping with. And I would like to see our denomination focus on other needs than that.
We'll hear from two ministers from the United Methodist Church with differing opinions after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. The United Methodist Church is the second largest Christian denomination in this country, and it faces a likely wave of defections after delegates at a crucial conference Tuesday voted to strengthen bans on same-sex marriage and gay and lesbian clergy. Emotions ran high, with some supporters of more LGBT inclusion in tears. Here with us is someone who was at that vote, the Reverend Joy Moore of Bethel United Methodist Church in Flint. Reverend Moore, what are your thoughts on yesterday's vote?
It was a difficult few days for the United Methodist Church. I don't think anyone won with that vote. What we attempted to do was continue the position that the denomination has always held. I think we hadn't recognized yet that the church had not moved as quickly as the culture. And by attempting to do that in an off-season focused vote, I think we did more harm in the conversations we had with one another, and seeing again, the majority still believes that our discipline is the church that they joined and the church that they want to remain a part of.
What are you hearing, Pastor Moore, from your own congregation about this debate? Is it on their radar?
It is less on our radar as an African-American congregation in Flint. The immediate needs of our community are more our focus. Our church is a help center, one of three help centers in the city. We distribute water, provide food for the homeless, provide various educational opportunities for people to understand where they can get help and where they can find opportunities for schooling or legal help, advice, and things of that nature. So for our congregation, which has a long history as the United Methodist Church, we were the first African-American congregation placed in that area. And after the other congregations, African-American congregations came to our area, they looked to the members of this congregation, which have been here for almost 100 years. And so their concern is the immediate needs of the community through this water crisis, providing water and filters and food. And so they're very clear about who they are and living out their identity as ambassadors for Christ. And so they're living that and are waiting to see, or we're waiting to see, what the denomination would do in terms of whether it would remain faithful to its doctrinal standards.
When you look at figures, the data tells us the United Methodist Church in this country has seen membership decline over the past 25 years. The median age is 57, so it's struggling to attract younger people, and these younger people are more likely to lean left on LGBT issues. Do you feel this vote will affect your church's ability to attract young Christians?
That is true. And one of the things that I think we fail to recognize is that a lot of young people are also choosing to join churches that give them an opportunity to be held accountable for a lifestyle I used to teach out in Southern California, and I had students say that the reason that they chose to go to a school that was traditional in its view was because they wanted to be held accountable to the values that they learned in the church. They were very clear about their identity. They were attracted to people of the same, their same gender. But they also believed that they wanted to live the life that they had been raised to live. And the gay community did not encourage them to be held in that kind of accountability. So they wanted a church to be the community that accepted who they are, but also held them accountable to the values of celibacy and singleness and fidelity in a heterosexual marriage. I found that probably one of the most convicting conversations that I had, to have young people in their early 20s say that what they wanted was to be a part of a church that held them accountable to what they understood the Bible to say God's call on their life was.
Well, we hear now that there are members of the clergy and there's Methodist congregations now deciding whether to split off from the church and that a wave of departures can be expected. Can these two halves of the church coexist?
And that's the pain that I think that this weekend demonstrated, is that we attacked one another. We spoke out of our passion and not out of our love for one another. And so things were said and some decisions were made in the heat of moments that make it hard for people to trust that we can live by the rules that the denomination has maintained for the last 40 years. And when you are a person that says, I surrender to these rules, it's hard to know what rules will be broken when you are with someone else who is saying, I'm going to be a part of this, but I'm not going to live by the rules that it demands. If you would allow me, let me try to say it this way. The church had been a place where in a culture that practiced many things that are normal for human beings to do, the church had been a safe place for a community of people to gather to say, we want to live by a higher standard, pointing beyond ourselves to the revelation of God's good in the world. We have found ourselves navel-gazing so that we are talking about what our self-satisfactions are and not what our what we would limit ourselves to. So that student that I was referencing, if the rules had changed in the denomination, could no longer trust that there is a church that will allow him to be held accountable to the Christian standards that his grandparents taught him that he wanted to accept. The question is whether or not people are willing to say, I accept the decision of the majority of this church that has been consistent for the last 40 years. The reason that both sides want to leave is because we can't seem to move across this almost 50% divide, and the people that are still in the majority cannot trust that they will not constantly be coerced to reconsider their positions. And that's what makes it hard to live together.
And in the final moments we have, do you believe, is this an existential threat to the United Methodist Church in our country?
As a denomination, I know it is a threat to our witness to the world, because on neither side are we saying to the world what we want to say. And that is, I think, what your question is. Can people of opposing views live together? And I believe that people with opposing views, with contradictory views, cannot live together, because you are not finding a paradox. You're not finding an irony. You're trying to constantly say one person is fundamentally wrong. And that is what has captivated us, if not for the last 40 years, definitely for the last 2 years. And as an African-American pastor in Flint, Michigan, there are so many other necessary needs of people's lives that are not focused on who they are sleeping with. And I would like to see our denomination focus on other needs than that.
The Reverend Joy Moore, pastor of Bethel United Methodist Church in Flint. Thank you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate, again, your taking this conversation.
And now we turn to someone with a different view about Tuesday's vote that strengthens the United Methodist Church ban on gay and lesbian clergy and same-sex marriage. Reverend Tim Ziegler is pastor of Westside United Methodist Church in Ann Arbor. Welcome, and tell us how you feel about Tuesday's vote.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sorry that it's under these circumstances. I and many of my colleagues throughout the United States, the state of Michigan, the city of Ann Arbor, and throughout the globe are really heartbroken today due to the events at the General Conference in St. Louis.
Why?
I just can't imagine the amount of pain and hurt that is being inflicted upon a group of folks that are already marginalized. And so I can sit here in this interview and thank you for this time, but I can't imagine what it's like to be on the margins like that, to be a part of that LGBTQIA community that is just so incredibly devastated at, once again, actions that are used to marginalize and not include.
I know the motto of the United Methodist Church is open hearts, open minds, open doors. Does that motto feel the same to you today?
No. I mean, we have a lot of work to do. But that is where the hope is. I mean, General Conference, thankfully, does not speak for God. General Conference is not going to release us as a local United Methodist Church from our responsibilities to proclaim the gospel openly to all people, no asterisks, to be as inclusive as we possibly can in all of our activities.
When you think of this vote, does it change anything about the choices that you're going to be making as a pastor to your congregation, particularly whether or not you would consider marrying a same-sex couple?
Those questions are always before us. And as a person of faith, I think one of the most important questions that I continually ask myself and challenge those in my congregation with, and now the congregation as a whole, is what is the next right thing for us to do? What are the next right steps for us to do? How can we be a fully inclusive church as a part of a global organization that is clearly not there with us? When the question comes to me personally being able to officiate same-sex marriage, I long for that day. I have since the beginning that I can remember. I mean, gay folks have always been a part of my life and deep friends, and I just long for that day. But so long as I do hold my membership within the annual conference, I feel like I'm being excluded from participating in those activities.
What would be the consequences based on yesterday's vote if someone were to say, I will marry you to a same-sex couple?
It's really harsh. I believe the first year you're suspended without pay, and then the second offense, you're defrocked. You lose your credentials within the United Methodist Church.
And that, so when we talk about seeing tears and seeing emotions, that's kind of where some of this is at.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what this is all about. I was really hopeful that the One Church plan could pass. Mm-hmm. I was hopeful that we were a denomination, which historically we have been, which is a big tent denomination. There's room for minority opinions. There's room for majority opinions. But for all of us in our diversity to still be united as Methodists, but that does not feel the same today.
7 million of you in this country. That, as you say, there's a lot of viewpoints in that tent. Yeah, I've got to wonder, when the ban on gay marriage was overturned in this country in 2013, did you feel that would kind of get things in motion and set up a scenario where your church would change as well, since that was where the country was headed?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that was such a welcome event within our country. And for equality and justice for all persons. And Westside Church is right there helping to fulfill that mission. And it is just so disconcerting that the United Methodist Church here globally has taken a step back. There is a word of hope, and that is that among the U.S. delegates to the General Conference, 66% of them were for full inclusion.
Yes, I saw that actually reported in the New York Times. So what about these folks? What about folks in your congregation, clearly you as their pastor, who are very saddened by what happened? What's ahead? I mean, can the two halves of these church coexist? What options are you weighing? Because we're hearing talk of waves of defections from the church.
Yeah. Today is really a day of mourning and grieving, both parts that are important to any faith journey. As we continue to ask the question as to what is next for us, I wish I had that answer. But I do think that everything is on the table for local congregations and for whole swaths of the country to perhaps find a new creation in the midst of this, of something that is perhaps dying, and to rise up as a progressive Methodist voice for the world today.
What are you hearing today from members of your congregation?
Just last night, we had our church council meeting for the month, and there were a lot of perspectives that were expressed. But one of them, from a very faithful person that I've gotten to know very well over these last 6 years, was just, you know, I don't know that me and my family would be able to support a denomination that has this stance. And quite honestly, I think that we're all in that time of discernment, those of us who have a heart for truly being an open and inclusive church for all persons. And just to – it's also a day for reconciliation, repentance. I mean, to ask for forgiveness for those that we are wronging in this instance. It's a bad day.
And yet we know, as we just heard in talking to Pastor Joy Moore from Flint, that the feeling was this was the right thing to do for the church, although painful. So here's the question. Is there a place for both of these viewpoints in the one church?
That is the tension. That is exactly what we're living into today. I don't know the answer to that. I hope that there is. But I also know that in order to be a fully inclusive church, a fully inclusive local congregation, there may come a point at which we need to make some important decisions for us.
What kind of direction or guidance have you gotten from your bishop? Have you heard? Have you been able to be in touch with your bishop since this?
Oh, yeah. Bishop David Bard is a wonderful person. He is able to live within this tension, knowing that it's coming from all different parts, and still maintain a less anxious presence in the center of it. And he was able to address through a Facebook Live conversation last night, you know, just a lot of this, like just a word of don't be non-anxious. That's not really accessible to us at this particular moment in time, but try to be less anxious and don't do anything too rash or too hasty. But just be with our people, you know, take some deep breaths, you know.
Is this an existential threat to the Methodist Church in the United States?
That is a wonderful question. As far as the Methodist movement will always be here, this movement that is so deeply rooted in Wesleyan theology and Arminian theology, it will always be a part of the United States. But in order to really own that progressive voice, I think that there will be room to start something new. That's my hope, or to be able to claim our identity within the larger whole while not sacrificing what is really important to us.
What does this debate within the second largest Christian denomination in this country, what does this mean to all of us in Michigan who are not members of the church but are watching this play out? What's the ripple effect throughout our state?
The message overall is that everyone is of sacred worth and value, and that there are movements that will attempt to marginalize folks. Those will not end up having the final say. There is still hope. There is still love, unconditional love. Love will win the day. Inclusion will win the day, moving to that place. But you know, fighting for civil rights, standing up for those who are marginalized and oppressed is something that the Methodist Church has been doing for hundreds of years and will continue to do, even in this present moment, even if it means taking a different form or shape.
The Reverend Tim Ziegler, pastor of Westside United Methodist Church in Ann Arbor, thank you so much for being with us.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank, engineered by Bob Scon. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Laura Weber Davis, Sarah Leeson, and Katie Raymond. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.